It's Behind the Headlines on WLIWFM, our weekly opportunity to sit down with the award-winning journalists who cover the East End for a deeper dive into the week's news. I'm Joe Shaw. I'm the executive editor of the Express News Group. We publish the Southampton Press, the East Hampton Press, the Sag Harbor Express, the website 27east.com, and Express Magazine. My co-host is Bill Sutton. He's the managing editor of the Express News Group. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody.
Great panel, as always, this week. We have Christine Sampson, who's the deputy managing editor of the East Hampton Star. Hey, Chrissy.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Beth Young, who's the editor of the East End Beacon. Hey, Beth.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Denise Civiletti, who's the editor of Riverhead Local. Hey, Denise.
How you doing?
Say hello so everybody can hear your voice.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello.
Chrissy, I want to start talking about school budgets. We had a lot that happened this past week. Some of the fallout from the conversations in Albany about the state budget are being felt locally. But even while there was some good news for school districts locally coming out of the governor's office, a lot of school districts announced this week that they're in tough shape, and probably nobody quite so much as Springs, right? Springs School District really has the toughest hill to climb here.
So Springs has, you know, basically, like, when you think about the properties that draw, that generate tax revenue in a community, you know, you got East Hampton and Bridgehampton. There's a lot of commercial activity there. There isn't a lot of commercial resources in Springs. And so the people, the homeowners, taxpayers shoulder most of that burden. And so when Springs is faced with all the same things that we're facing at home, rising utility costs and insurance costs more, and, you know, different elements of rising costs, tuition is rising, everything like that, it's hitting Springs a little bit harder than it does elsewhere, right? So Springs is looking at an 11.71% tax levy increase, which is mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. Also, it's the bare minimum, the district is saying, the bare minimum of what they need to just maintain, not expand, not, you know, grow in leaps and bounds. They just want to maintain. The only thing I think that would be a new element is that they're going to replace an outdated reading curriculum with more one called the Science of Reading, because right now they were heavily relying on that teacher's college curriculum that a lot of school systems are dropping. Very, you know, what people are saying is an outdated approach to teaching reading. But Springs, you know, they have a lot of work to do ahead of them in terms of reaching out to the community. That looks like an almost $700 increase for an average house in Springs.
Wow. Taxes.
That's a big bite.
Yeah, and the alternatives aren't great, right, Chrissy? Because now, because of the increase, they're going to need to get 60% of the homeowners, the voters in the district to approve the budget. If they don't, it gets worse, right?
I mean, it gets worse.
The tax impact is a little less, but
it's not. I think if you balance what the tax impact would be of a contingency budget, which is basically no tax levy increase, versus what is at stake here, I think that, you know, if you have any inclination towards, you know, caring about children, like, you have a tough decision to make in terms of, like, you know, taxes versus supporting the children. These kids are still suffering from the pandemic.
Right.
The effects of the pandemic. Their test scores are lower. You know, they're having emotional, they need emotional support, mental health support. And this is how we do it. This is how public schools do it. They rely on their taxpayers, you know?
Mm-hmm. And Springs is, you know, under this budget, they would be maintaining the current programs. Unlike some other districts, Southampton, West Hampton Beach, Riverhead, that are cutting staff and, you know, and letting teachers go and not filling open positions and stuff. And I think Springs is probably down to kind of threadbare already, not being able to do that. But that seems like an option in some other districts, and, you know, including, you know, Riverhead's laying off a lot of teachers, right, Denise?
Yeah, a lot of teachers and staff.
Yeah.
Some of whom were hired with federal coronavirus relief money.
Mm-hmm.
But some are not. I mean, you know, they're just like, they're cutting because they've got to cut. And again, it's the same kind of thing where to just stand still, they've got to eliminate positions because of rising costs. And, you know, it's just goes back to how education, the way it's funded in the state of New York, is really a mess. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's ever going to be adequately addressed because it's too big a thing. And, you know,
I think there's another thing at stake in that, you know, Joe, you referenced that the governor's and the state legislature has agreed in its upcoming state budget to not decrease foundation aid to school districts, right? So Fred Thiel, our assemblyman, is saying that this week, you know, we've got the hold harmless clause where schools will still receive the same amount they received last year, if not more, right? Mm-hmm. But the timing of this is crazy because the schools are expected to adhere to a state system, a timeline that has them adopting their budgets before the state funding is even set in stone. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the budget debates are still going on, and who knows how it's going to actually. The problem was that Governor Hochul's proposed budget had talked about eliminating that hold harmless clause and begin to ratchet back some of that foundation funding. And she said this week that that's now off the table as part of the budget negotiations. She's agreed
for this year,
to pull that down for now. Yeah. But she has said that they need to have a conversation about a new strategy and a new calculation going forward for this foundation aid money. That's going to be a long-term conversation, I think, in Albany. But Chrissy, this goes back to a conversation we have all the time, which is these small districts, and Springs certainly is one of the smaller districts in the region. They see these giant swings in financial impacts, and they have a much harder time adapting. Like when we talked about Southampton and Riverhead, and some of the bigger districts have options whenever the funding is cut, or when there's some, you know, when as you said, utility costs rise, some of the other things they have no control over, they can adapt. They can make some cuts. They can make some moves. A school district like Springs, which has a small set of, you know, a small set of numbers to work with, really doesn't have a lot of flex room.
Yeah, not a lot of flex room at all. And one of the things is that Springs is a pre-K to 8 school district, right? They send their high schoolers to East Hampton on a tuition paid basis. And that's mandatory. Like, you can't just stop educating kids at eighth grade, right? And
they have no control over what they're paying.
They have no control over that. So there is an element, right? So when they negotiate a 5-year tuition contract with East Hampton, like, the voters approve that contract, you know, so they approve it 5 years at a time with prescribed and predictable tax increase, like tuition increases in those numbers. And, you know, they tie the tuition increase to the CPI, the consumer price index, that also impacts the tax levy legislation overall, that tax levy system. But like, you know, they just don't have a choice. So like, when tuition rises to send their kids to East Hampton and they have to make corresponding cuts, they have to look inside their school building for those cuts. Right. Larger class sizes as a result of teacher layoffs, you know, different special education models, because there are rising costs in special education too. You know, a lot of resources are hard to find out here. So you have to pay those teachers and those service providers a little more, because otherwise you won't get them to come out all the way over here. You know, there's a lot of factors at play.
I hear an affordable housing conversation coming.
Right.
Yes.
And traffic.
In seeping in. Yes.
I would like to speak to something Chrissy mentioned before, because this is something that's kind of vexes all of us in Riverhead and certainly has, you know, puzzled me for a long time. There is an explanation for it, though. And that is the commercial tax base that you referenced before, Chrissy. Riverhead certainly has its share and then some of commercial tax ratables. You know, I mean, look at Route 58 and all the big box stores. And, you know, we've got the Grumman property, which, although that big piece of land is undeveloped still, there's still the industrial core that's all developed. I mean, we've got commercial properties up the wazoo, right? So why are our taxes still going up? Why do we have such high taxes to begin with? Like, what benefit did we get from all of that other than, you know, that creepy little four-lane highway that was supposed to ease the traffic problem? And the reason for that is the way commercial properties under New York state law are assessed for taxes. Mm-hmm. They are not based on the like an appraised value of the land. You can have something that sells for $50 million, but
the perfect example being the golf courses in the Tuckahoe School District, which cover lots of acreage worth millions and millions of dollars, but not assessed on that.
The taxes are assessed, I think from what I remember, the golf courses, the taxes are assessed by how much money the pro shops make, which is just ridiculous.
Well, the state real property tax law requires that these commercial properties be assessed on how much money they make, their profits are, when you talk to the assessors,
What about mixed-use buildings?
Well, they're supposed to be assessed also on how much money they make. I mean, you know,
profits.
It's the same thing in commercial properties.
And
the assessors will say, how are we supposed to really know that?
Right.
How are we supposed to really know that? We don't know that until they come in with their profit and loss and say, here's how much money we didn't make last year, and we're over-assessed.
And they're always very honest about that, right?
I don't know. But that doesn't even happen until they're already in a grievance procedure with the town.
Yeah.
So if you look at any town, if you just search the name of a town in the court records, the online court records, you're going to see literally hundreds of tax certiorari, it's called, these tax cases. It's painful what happens to them. I mean, I don't think it's the fault of the assessors at all. I think they know what they're doing. They're doing the best they can. But this is another sort of flaw. This is how we're mandated to fund education based on property taxes. And, you think you need to have commercial development that, it's development that, doesn't put kids in schools too, right? That's another thing you hear all the time. But in the end, it doesn't really produce the tax revenues that everybody thinks it should produce or would produce. So it's a very vexing problem, and it's something that needs state legislative action. And I don't feel like there's too much of an appetite to do that, because I would also say New York City school taxes are not generated that way.
But it contributes to the inequity. And Chrissy, the question I have for you is, we have this system in place now where, as you said, let's take Springs as an example, pre-K to eighth grade. And they send their kids from there via tuition to East Hampton School. And so you have to pay that tuition. At what point does this Rube Goldberg system that we have set up with the districts doing this, do we do away with this and start talking about consolidation and creating a system where these smaller districts are automatically feeding, the kids to regional high schools? It makes so much more sense. It's basically the way the current system is migrating via the tuition system. But instead, we have all these administrators, we have all this infrastructure that we probably don't need.
Yeah, so that's a good point. That's going to ultimately be the conversation we have to have, because some years ago, they did a high school feasibility study to make a high school in Springs, right? Was going to cost too much money, be too much of a bear to take on, right? So now we have this tuition system continuing in East Hampton. But what it's going to look like first, I think, is shared services. Right. Mm-hmm. So Sag Harbor Schools providing busing for Sagaponack and Wainscott, and East Hampton's business official is currently serving as Springs's business official. These are this is what it's going to look like. And I think that will whet people's palate for more. And I think that will make the consolidation conversation a little more palatable in the coming years.
I agree.
It's going to have to happen. And, I might lose a lot of friends in the world of education for saying that, but I personally...
It's just a reality, though, right?
I mean, why do we need you know, 124 superintendents on Long Island. Why exactly. do we need?
I'll make in $200,000 to $300,000 a year.
Right. And so, you know, maybe this model where East Hampton's business official helps out in Springs, maybe, and we have Amagansett's treasurer helping out in Springs also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Springs lost their business guy in the middle of budget season. And that's where, you know, there's a team effort here to make sure that Springs is still taken care of, which is admirable. And I think it's a model.
I think it's gonna take people speaking up and really starting to spark a conversation about consolidation. Before we leave the topic, Chrissy, there was a point you wanted to make about just something that might be helpful for people to know. But, you know, when we sort through school budgets, and I know this is always difficult even for us, you know, we deal with it on an annual basis, but trying to understand the mechanisms of school budgets and the terminology can be really daunting, especially for folks out there who aren't doing it regularly. You found a resource that's really helpful though.
Yeah. So I want to direct your attention to the YouTube feed of LTV Studios, the East Hampton Public Access channel. They have a publicly available video of the Springs budget workshop from this past Tuesday, April 9th, in which Sam Schneider, their borrowed business official, at timestamp 31 minutes and 22 seconds, mark that down, goes into a very detailed explanation of tax levy versus tax rate versus assessed value that I think is required listening for anybody who wants to understand their school budget tax bill a little bit better, understand what they're going to be voting on May 21st more clearly. You know, it was a very interesting and educational, informative few minutes there. I mean, it's like less than 10 minutes from that 31 minute mark, LTV East Hampton YouTube. And just to give it a watch, it'll be really informative. Really,
one of the things that's always driven me crazy is when officials talk about how they've cut taxes when they cut a tax rate, when that's not necessarily true. That sometimes the tax levy is actually increasing even as the tax rate is going down, and that's complicated for people to understand. But it means that some people's tax bills are going to actually go up. And I just think people need to educate themselves more. It's a great resource to do that. I mean, it's complicated for all of us who deal with it constantly. I can't imagine for somebody who's just coming in cold and trying to understand the tax system, for sure.
There are also some pretty good explainers on the state comptroller's website about that issue and others that pertain to education financing that are like in plain English and I found easy to understand.
Good stuff. That's helpful for people, I think. This is Behind the Headlines on WLIW-FM. I'm Joe Shaw. My co-host is Bill Sutton. We are with the Express News Group. And our panelists today are Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local, Beth Young of the East End Beacon, and Chrissy Sampson of the East Hampton Star. I do want to switch gears and talk about the EPA. Denise, they made a big announcement this week about water quality. It's about PFAS, which is something we've been talking about and writing about quite a bit. This is a big step, right? The EPA is taking a giant step.
It is, because it's for the first time setting a national standard for drinking water standard for those contaminants. And it's been a long time coming. They had this lifetime exposure, you know, lifetime health advisory measure, which, you know, good luck trying to figure out what that translates into when you take a glass of water from your tap. But, you know, it's what was really needed was this drinking water standard, and they set a maximum contamination level, sorry, MCL, of 4 parts per trillion. And so that is really, really small. Like, you might remember that in 2020, New York State, I think it was the first in the nation to set an MCL for PFAS. And it's at 10. So the EPA really, you know, went way farther than that.
Remind people what we're talking about, too. What
sure.
What
I was
are
just about
substances?
To. Thank you. I was about to do that. So I'm not going to even try to pronounce the words that PFAS stands for, but they're basically chemicals, man-made chemicals, or chemicals that are produced in the manufacturing process of certain things. And they are like widespread in so many places in our environment that they have found themselves, you know, their way into our groundwater all over the place.
And they don't break down, found, right?
They're called forever chemicals. Thank you. That's because they don't break down and they accumulate, they bioaccumulate. And it, like, so the fish will take it up and then you eat the fish and then, you know, it accumulates. They said we can't find anybody without some level of PFAS in their bloodstream. That's how prevalent.
It was in nonstick cookware and furniture protectors, firefighting foam. Those are some of the biggest.
And
firefighting foam was one of the big ones because it was used at the airports. And so you see a lot of this contamination.
For firefighter training. And
right.
Yep. Yeah. So it's like, you know, and you find these chemicals in biggest concentrations in like industrial areas. So, I mean, no surprise. There's lots of that in the soil and the groundwater underneath, like the EPCAL site, which was a former naval weapons manufacturing plant in Calverton. The DEC said that the water under the Riverhead landfill had 10 times the state level, the maximum level allowed. So it's a serious problem. As far as we know, there's one Riverhead Water District well that is contaminated with PFAS. Also, I should point out these chemicals are known to be linked to cancer and other health problems, diseases of the thyroid, the immune system.
A wide range of health issues.
A wide range of things. So, you know, it's serious stuff and it needs to be addressed. And, you know, the manufacturers that create these chemicals, need to be, I think, held responsible for it. And that's something that localities have been working on with lawsuits and stuff. But, you know.
So what's the bottom line with the EPA standards now? It's going to force.
Drinking water is going to have to. Yeah. I mean, drinking water that's supplied by community and public water supply companies and, you know, is going to have to meet this
like standard. Suffolk County Water Authority.
Like Suffolk County Water Authority, Riverhead Water District, Hampton Bays Water District. They still have a water district. Bays Water District.
And Hampton Bays has had some contamination too. So.
Yeah. And it's not that it can't be remedied. It can be. But of course, like everything else, it's expensive. And so who bears the cost of this? And the federal infrastructure law supposedly, you know, going to fund $1 billion, but $1 billion divided by however many like water, you know, providers there are in the nation, really, it's not that much money, really, when you think about it. So I don't know where this is going to go, but it's necessary. And, you know, it needs to be cleaned up. I mean, it's in the Peconic River. It's migrating. The interesting thing here in Riverhead, and not to talk about EPCAL again, but I can't help it, is that, you know, there's a lot of groundwater pollution at that site, and it's migrating. There are plumes migrating off the EPCAL site, south and southeast, contaminating homes that don't currently have access to public water, with the water district's working on it. But, you know, and they have private drinking water wells that are, you know, some of them have had PFAS, you know, they've been detected. It's been detected in those wells. But the Navy has refused to acknowledge New York State's maximum contaminant level and said, no, we have to, you know, we're going by the 70 parts per billion, lifetime advisory thing, where maybe it was even per million. And even after the EPA lowered the lifetime advisory level, they were still sticking with the 70. I don't know.
I wonder if this will have an impact then.
They're going to be really hard pressed to, you know, justify not dealing with that at this, with this, I think, with this MCL, this new standard.
And it's in a lot of federal sites. Every defense site you look at, probably.
Right. That's why they're afraid to acknowledge it.
Right.
I mean, that same kind of thing is happening in Bethpage, and they're, you know, they've got something in the ringer over there.
Yeah,
what's happening?
Been training all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, Beth, it's worth saying that Suffolk County Water Authority said this week that they actually welcomed this and that they are sort of ahead of the curve on this. They've been setting up filters and doing the necessary work on filtering out PFAS. You got to give the Water Authority credit. They have been ahead of the curve on this. They've been working on it for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think they knew this was coming down. And, you know, having New York standards being 10 parts per trillion really is a lot closer than 70 than yeah, where the EPA 70, would get
yeah,
per billion.
And then so, advisor, lifetime advisor.
Right, yes. So
sort of meaningless.
But yeah, I mean, you know, if you're on public water, the last couple of years there's been a $20 per quarter surcharge to go toward this and to go toward treatment of 1,4 dioxin. They were the Water Authority initially was hoping, or they said they were hoping to recoup this from the manufacturers and then not charge the customers anymore. But that might be a pipe dream. I'm not sure.
Did the Water Authority, the Suffolk County Water Authority, join that class action lawsuit against 3M and DuPont and stuff?
Yeah.
I worry, too, about the smaller districts like Hampton Bays Water District, which is going to have to probably step up its game a little bit, too, I would think.
Going to have to meet the same standards. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
but they've done some work too over the last few years. I know that there was one well that they put in, they brought in new equipment to help filter that stuff out.
Right. Wells near the fire department training?
I think, yeah.
Okay. So, I think there was an issue with one well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
That they ended up having to shut down, but yeah, I think there's been a lot of attention paid to PFAS in the region over the last couple of years, and this is I think it's allowed them to get ahead of the curve a little bit on this.
Well, I mean, since the state level, you know, since the state set the drinking water standard for New York, they have to pay attention to it. You know, like
right.
So
and, I mean, it can be treated with activated carbon filtration, like you know, charcoal, which
in your house, even
in your fish tank, you know. So it's not like you need very high tech solutions, whereas like something like 1,4 dioxin, you do. One thing is like this EPA ruling only covers like 6 out of hundreds of perfluorinated compounds that exist. And, you know, these are the PFAS ones that they're focusing on are the ones that they've done the most study on, but, you know, they're still making firefighting foam, and firefighters still use it for vehicle accidents. They use it, you know, anywhere where there's a like gasoline or any kind of flammable liquid involved. They, you know, like at an airport where there's jet fuel. The newer compounds just haven't been studied on yet. So, you know,
so they could be just as bad. They just don't know yet.
The fire service is dealing with huge cancer issues as it is, and you know this is
a great point, Beth. That we talk about the groundwater issues, but this has an effect on firefighters too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, people who like volunteer their time after dinner go put out a car parking lot of the firehouse. You know.
Well, the new EPA standard should at least backs up the state's aggressive approach on this, and you hope it sort of cushions the blow a little bit that New York has been dealing with this in recent years, and it may not create too much of a major stressor on New York State.
Well, you've got to make sure though that those homes that are still on well water get onto the public water. I mean, we just had $1.5 million bucks in West Hampton to get 50 or so people onto public water because of PFAS. And I think about those people in Calverton in that area that they've got a federal government's got to come in with some money to do that, to get but them does, hooked up.
Does Riverhead have the money yet or not?
No, they don't have all the money yet. They've been piecemealing it with, this grant, that grant, and they're waiting for some grants that got approved already to be delivered to them. And I think that the homes in the Matterville area where the people have been kind of mobilized and organized those should, because the Riverhead worked out a deal with the Water Authority to kind of piggyback on their labor and, you know, their organization. And they're closer, their main is closer to that area. So they've worked something out with them to, you know, provide the water there. And last I heard, that should be happening in the next month sometime. That should begin. And there's this other area, like southeast, where they're working on, you know, there's another extension planned and they're working on, they just got more money to fund that. It's hard to keep track of all the different, you know, all different grants.
True on the South Fork too. The one thing that did come out of this is folks in Waynescott, and I believe in Hampton Bays, and definitely in West Hampton, were added to the public water supply and taken off private wells, which gives you at least some ability to have some control over the impact. So that is something that came out of the PFAS response locally too.
The DEC was offering residents with private wells without access to public water in a different area of Calverton, having nothing, as far as we know, to do with the EPCAL site. These whole house filtration systems, and they have been delivering bottled water to these folks, which is, it's another form of a major expense, because that all adds up as well. So, another fine mess you created.
And living on bottled water is not the easiest thing in the world to do.
And you're still showering with the water that's contaminated too. So that's not really
I'll remind people that this is Behind the Headlines on WLIWFM. I'm Joe Shaw. My co-host is Bill Sutton. Our panelists are Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local, Beth Young of the East End Beacon, and we had Chrissy Sampson of the East Hampton Star, but she was pulled away. We thank her for the time she was able to give us this morning. But we'll move on. I do want to talk about Riverhead, the changing landscape in Riverhead, Denise, and apparently, there's another big project being proposed, and someone, the IDA up there, is offering some tax breaks to allow that to happen.
There's more than one project being proposed, but this one has actually been approved. It got town board final site plan or preliminary, but like it's got its approvals in December, then it went to the Riverhead Industrial Development Agency to apply for financial benefits, financial assistance to build a project. It's an $82 million project. It's being developed by an LLC that's an affiliate of Heatherwood's, a real estate developer company. They develop all different kinds of apartment complexes and things like that.
So this is a 165-unit apartment building right on Main Street.
Yep, wow. It's market. So you know where the Sears store was? Mm-hmm. Like, remember that? So it's on that site. There was Sears and then a number of other stores that were separate but same owner. And that got torn down. And there's been a big vacant lot there. It's an acre and a half, I think, 1.4 acres. And it's between the Arts Council School building, which is this, like, 19th century home converted to a school use a long time ago. It's between that and the Riverview Lofts, another five-story apartment building on East Main Street in the corner of McDermott Avenue. So this is on the eastern part of central Riverhead Business District. This is considered, these are market rate apartments. They're not getting subsidized by federal estate tax credits or anything like that. And the rents are like, you're talking for a two-bedroom apartment, like the astronomical two-bedroom apartments, like $3,600. And for a studio, it was like $2,400. This is what they're saying that they're expecting. And they think that the market is there for it. And there's this another apartment building that's occupied already that's market rate on East Main Street. And it's called a Shipyard. It used to be a little house there that had a Subway sandwich shop. I don't know. But that also has similar rents and people who live in there. So I don't know.
Not for nothing. That's almost affordable housing on the East End anymore.
Yeah, I guess so. It just blows my mind, though. But yeah. So they got this the financial assistance in the form of real property tax reductions over a 16-year period, along with sales tax and mortgage recording tax exemptions, which adds up to it's a multi-million dollar savings package for this developer.
This is a lot of construction in Riverhead, though, right? I mean, it's a lot
of housing on Main Street,
yeah. And you know, housing. I
think you're creating a community there. I think which isn't horrible.
I think that's the idea. That's what they're trying to do. I mean, the philosophy of this is that, you know, if you bring people into a downtown, as like look at Patchogue, everybody looks at Patchogue. That's what Patchogue did, and you know, people live there. They're on the street, and they will support downtown businesses, restaurants, and whatever else gets, you know,
occupies the storefront. We didn't happen across the river.
Well, yeah, that like well, this is a good segue to that discussion. Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, that's the theory here, and that's the premise that they've been working on, and that is going to be the key to revitalization of Riverhead's, you know, long flagging downtown district.
Denise.
That's what they got this $10 million grant for, too. I mean,
So is this part of a plan from Riverhead officials? Is this according to a plan they've had over the years?
Well, yeah. I mean, this was actually, this goes back to the 2003 comprehensive plan update, and it was a much debated and controversial thing then. And they put a cap on the number of apartments allowed in the DC1 zoning district, which is essentially along Main Street. To 500 apartments. They're at that now, but that cap does not apply to the other zoning districts that are kind of like around Main Street. And there's another apartment building planned for West Main Street and at the corner of Sweezy Avenue, kind of like just west of the library and the bridge that goes over to where the jail is, to the Center Drive, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
There's another building plan there. There's another building planned. Well, there's another building going up right now on Osborne Avenue next to the library. And there's another building planned for what is currently a municipal parking lot on Osborne and Railroad Avenue across from the train station. And then there's another apartment building plan for the Suffolk County parking lot where the Cooperative Extension building used to be, right next door to our office on Griffin Avenue. And that's across from the court. So
does Riverhead have the infrastructure for all this?
Well, that's, you know, that is the rub in my opinion. I mean, you know, all of these things, but then again, the developers contribute money toward the infrastructure, like the water district, the sewer district, et cetera. But now we can, here we go, let's segue. But what they don't presently have is a whole lot of sewage treatment capacity for all of this. They also don't have parking capacity for all of this. And now they are proceeding, I would say pretty much full steam ahead at this point, with building a parking garage in the First Street parking lot, which is between Main Street. It's called First Street, but it was obliterated by a parking lot many years ago. But it's it's between the north side of north of Main Street and Second Street in downtown Riverhead. But they don't have a whole lot of sewer district capacity, and they really want to get back the capacity that's being used up by the Riverhead County Center offices and a correctional facility across the river in the town of Southampton. And they are objecting to the current plan by the town of Southampton to put a sewage treatment plant in Riverside to support the Riverside Action Plan and the Riverside Revitalization Plan, and that's to support that development. And they want, but the county facilities, which are in the town of Southampton in Riverside, are not included at present in this Riverside sewer district.
So and Beth, can you pick that up? We had some developments on that this week that there was a bit of a step forward with the Riverside development, right?
Right. Yeah. Southampton Town's been holding a number of public hearings on the sewage treatment plant plan, which was called for in a document they passed with much fanfare 10 years ago about redeveloping Riverside. And that would involve up to, I believe, 2,300 apartments that could be built, you know, if you have people who want to build them. But that's all dependent on this sewer district being formed. So, you know, there was a lot of work had to be done to get the funding for it. This public hearing process has been going on since December. So they closed the public hearing on the plan on Tuesday, April 9th, accepted the environmental impact statement amendment for it, and voted to spend some community preservation fund money on it. I believe the total cost is about $35 million.
But most of that funding is in place, right? I mean, there were grants and
yeah, there were several federal grants. I think there were at least two $5 million federal grants. The Environmental Facilities Corporation is giving them a no interest loan, and they're using several million dollars of CPF.
Because it's kind of a blighted area.
Yeah. And Southampton uses up to 20% of its CPF money for water quality.
Right.
Poor towns don't really have enough money to do that sort of thing in their CPFs. I'm sure they'd love to have that kind of money floating around. Mm-hmm. But the issue with the county center has been going back years. And at the public hearing on Tuesday, Vince Taldone, the former president of the Flanders Riverside Northampton Community Association, said he was talking with former Riverhead supervisor Sean Walter about this 10 years ago. And he said Riverhead needed the revenue from the county center at the time and didn't want to give it back to Southampton. Mm. So Southampton was planning on adding this, on moving the county center into their system in a later phase of this sewage treatment plan, because they're like going out from where the site is. And the site is, if you know Flanders Road at all, it's a little industrial park behind the Suffolk Credit Union building. Mm-hmm. On Flanders Road. And actually, this has just come up lately. As the crow flies, it's right behind Riverhead's Central School District's Phillips Avenue School. So
people are objecting to that. So parents
are kind of just getting wind that this is being built behind their school.
Pun intended there, the wind.
Got wind of it.
Yeah,
because exactly. One of their big complaints is that it's gonna smell.
Yeah.
So for broader context here, I think to put this in a broader context, I think both the school district and the town of Riverhead are using this sewage treatment plant issue as sort of like a wedge, really.
Yeah.
Would you agree? I mean, because they are both opposed to the overall development plan. I think that's very clear. They've both made that clear at prior public hearings and prior presentations. The school district is concerned about the number of children it's going to put in the school. They're concerned about overcrowding of Phillips Avenue Elementary School in particular. Riverhead Town is, they are legit worried. They want that capacity back, but there's more to it than that. I mean, I think, there may be some concern that there's going to be a glut of this housing, maybe. I don't know. I mean, they've said a number of different things. And in fact, they've hired an attorney for advice on what they can potentially do to stop this from a legal standpoint.
Yeah.
This has been a project that has just faced so many challenges along the years, right? This is something that's been talked about, as you alluded to earlier, for well over a decade. And it's just part of the problem has been this friction with Riverhead, right? I mean, it's in the background of this conversation all the time.
Yeah. I'd have to go back and read the document, but the Riverside Revitalization Action Plan that was adopted 10 years ago gave developers the possibility for like more intense development if they met certain community building criteria, like providing public spaces or providing affordable housing, things like that. And I don't believe anything's written in there where they have to help do extra to fund the school, which may, in hindsight, might have been I don't know how they would legally set that up, but the school district needs help. It needs all the help it can get.
Yeah. I would also point out, though, like none of this was exactly done in secret. You know,
right.
I mean, there were a ton of public meetings. There was a working group. The school district had a seat at the table and participated. Riverhead was offered a seat at the table, but didn't fully participate. And so, like, you know, they like went along and did what they were. You know, this is like a classic thing of, you know, entities operating in their own silos, kind of, you know, and now it's
almost like they thought this would never happen.
I think that's accurate.
Things never happened.
I think they were counting on it never really happening. But, you know, also Riverhead is currently in a lawsuit and has been for a while now with the county of Suffolk over the sewer rates that the county is paying Riverhead to have its waste from that facility treated. That's another thing that's going on here. Their contract expired a few years ago, and they raised their rates, and the county doesn't want to pay the higher rate. So there's that lawsuit is kicking. We spend more money on lawsuits than on infrastructure, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a shame, because I think we've said it before that if Riverhead and Southampton Towns had kind of worked together on development plans on both sides of the river, then it would have benefited both towns. And now you've got this infighting going on as Riverhead has gone and done its own thing, you know, and now Southampton is left to its own devices. I mean, it's such a pretty beautiful area, you know, around the river that if they had worked together on a development plan that they both could have benefited, I think.
And I feel that downtown Riverhead revitalization is really very hooked up with Riverside revitalization. I don't think you can feasibly separate those two things. Mm.
Do you think the Riverhead folks agree with you, though?
No, I don't think they agree with me on much of anything.
The government or the people?
I thought he was talking about the government. Yeah,
I was, yes. But I don't know.
They don't act like they think that, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think they act like they think that. But
it's amazing how that line in the river makes all the
line.
Difference in the world.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is because that line separates Southampton Town and Riverhead Town. If you get in an Uber on the Riverhead side of the river, it costs half the price than if you get in an Uber on the Southampton side of the river, because Uber rates are double in the Hamptons.
No kidding.
So,
imaginary lines.
Going to work or even going to Suffolk Community College, paying double for
such
an Uber,
impact.
Living in Riverside.
As an Uber driver, part-time sometimes, I have seen that, and it's unfortunate because I pick people up in Riverside and Flanders that are going to work on Route 58 in Riverhead, and they're paying, you know, it's good for me, but they're paying, you know, they're paying an exorbitant rate just to go to work, which is crazy.
Or to college.
Or to college. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
That public transit system is...
It's replacing it's another ad hoc public transit
system.
Well,
that's another thing. You know, this Suffolk County bus realignment hasn't faced a summer season yet.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be an interesting test of that, right? This is the on-call bus system.
The on-call and also the changes to the S-92.
Right.
Things are not lining up the way they used to. And once the buses start running late because of Hampton's traffic, it's really not going to work like they thought. Like the consultants from far away thought it was going to work.
Who had no idea how it gets.
They've never sat in that traffic.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So we have a couple minutes left before we end. I do want to give Denise a chance to talk a little bit about a story she wrote this week. There's a fairly sizable Ukrainian community in Riverhead, right? And you wrote about a member of that community this week. Tell us about
it. Yeah, so I had word of this Riverhead High School student who's a sophomore this year, came to Riverhead with his parents and his sister 2 years ago. He just turned 16, March 30th. And, you know, he is a promising young boxer. And so For the first time in my life, I had the chance to go into a boxing gym.
Where is the which boxing gym?
It's Hill Street Boxing, which I think they started out or have a location on the south side over there. But
in Southampton, they started off in Southampton, yeah.
And they have a place on Columbus Avenue in Riverhead. And so I met this kid. He his trainer's actually a teacher in he teaches mathematics in West Hampton Beach High School. But he's a boxing trainer and loves boxing. And he saw this kid at the gym and started talking to him and worked with him a little bit and said he has real potential. And the kid did some boxing in Ukraine. They fled the country when the war broke out a couple of years ago. And he came here and he was kind of, you know, at a loss and socially and in new country, new culture, new language, new alphabet. You know, he had a hard time making friends. And when he came to the gym, he was with his peeps. Like he had, you know, they all speak the same language. I think it's a lot of grunting and boxing, but really, really sweet kid. And he packs a pretty mean punch. I mean, his whole personality seems to visibly transform when he steps into the ring with the mitts and gloves on and stuff. I struggle to write the story because I don't really know the boxing lingo or anything like that. My exposure to boxing is I cover my eyes when I walk through the living room and Peter's watching a boxing match. But he's got some real potential. And it was a nice story because this man took him, this teacher from West Hampton Beach, kind of took him under his wing, takes him to matches and sparring.
That's sparring. Justin Matera.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. This kid, his nickname is Alexei, his Alexander. And he's just kind of flourishing and, coming into his own at 16. He's boxing with adults with much more experience. And, you know, Mr. Matera is really very gung-ho about his future. So it was kind of a cool story. But
that's great.
Like I said,
Hill Street has really thrived. I mean, you know, they did start off in Southampton, but they're expanding and they just do great work with local kids.
I always marvel at how many of those stories are out in our communities. And it's great when you track one down, Denise. We'll have to talk. We may have to pick that story up.
Yeah.
Okay.
It sounds like one that we should share.
Yeah, definitely got cross pollination potential.
Yeah, it'd be nice to share with our readers as well, I think. So we are officially out of time now. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the earthquake and the eclipse.
Oh, no.
My goodness. Mother Nature reminded us that. And the floods, yes. So Mother Nature reminded us that she's still taking headlines away. Thank you to our panelists. Earlier to Chrissy Sampson of the East Hampton Star, Beth Young of the East End Beacon, and Denise Civility of Riverhead Local. Thank you guys for being here. And thank you to my co-host, Bill Sutton. I'm Joe Shaw. We will be back next week with another edition of Behind Headlines. Thanks, everybody.